are listening to the Confronting Christianity podcast, and I'm here with my friend Vermone Pierre, a Pastor Pierre. Do you go by Pastor Pierre or Pastor Vermone or anything like that, or just by Vermone in your
congregation? Depends the how old the person is who's talking to me. Pastor V is a popular way in which people talk
Pastor
to me.
Pastor V. Okay, Pastor I love v. it. Okay, we're going to...
But
gonna
Vermone is good.
I know, I'm going to call you Pastor V from now on. Like, not just in this podcast, but every time I see you.
I expect
Pastor
that.
V holds a BA from Princeton University and MDiv from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. He's the lead pastor at Roosevelt Community Church, which is a diverse, multi-ethnic congregation in downtown Phoenix, Arizona. He's the author of Gospel-Shaped Living, and his most recent book, which is one that we're going to be able to dive into a little bit today, is called Dearly Beloved, How God's Love for His Church Deepens Our Love for Each Other. And if you are somebody who's listened to the Confronting Christianity podcast before, you will know that some of the things I care most about in the world are things that Vermone is writing about in this book. But yeah, I'm excited for people to get to know you, Vermone, who aren't yet familiar with you and your work. Tell us, Pastor V. Tell us, Pastor V. just give us a day in the life of Pastor V. Like, what is day-to-day life look like for you? Many people listening today are not pastors and may even not know any pastors, and they might have a whole range of ideas and visions of what it looks like. So tell us what Pastor V's day-to-day looks like.
Often depends on the day, but almost every weekday, it's getting up a little bit before 7 with my 2.5-year-old and getting her ready for preschool, and then getting my 14-year-old ready to head out the door for the school that he goes to. And so I usually drop him off first, then I come back for the 2.5-year-old and my 9-year-old to get them to their different schools. And so it's always a bit of a mad rush get everyone.
That is 3 kids out of 5. Is that, am I correct?
That is 3 kids out of 5. That's right.
So just give us the ages.
So 22-year-old boy. Well, not boy. I guess he's a man now. See how I think. No, but he's a 20-year-old man. 19-year-old. She is a college student at ASU. Then I have the 14-year-old boy, 9-year-old girl, and 2.5-year-old girl.
Love it. Amazing.
It was a bit of a surprise, but we love her.
So Pastor V gets up in the morning. The first thing he does is a lot of fathering. Fantastic.
That's right. And then head into the office. Sometimes I have some time for some personal Bible reading and prayer. But usually on Tuesdays, I'm heading to the office, and those are just meeting days at our church. Mm-hmm. Wednesdays are usually a combination of meeting days. Try to do a lot of my counseling or just meeting with people that they want to meet with me on Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. Thursdays and Fridays tend to be more focused on anything I'm working on, projects, whether it's writing, definitely sermon stuff if I'm preaching that Sunday. Often some things bleed into that. If I can't, there's sometimes meetings, one or two meetings I might have to do in those days. I work better when I block things. And so I try to sort of have meetings earlier in the week, and then any study, writing, research that I need to do in the latter half of the week.
Interesting. Okay. I like that. Yeah. I'm more of a chaotic human. So I have a lot less blocking, but that makes a lot of sense. Tell us a little bit. So, as I say, some people listening to this podcast will be people who regularly participate in the life of a local church. Other people, maybe that was what they did once upon a time, or maybe they've never been part of a church and it's sort of a little bit alien or curious to them what it would look like to be part of a church, and why somebody would even bother to be part of a church. So do you mind just telling us, like, how did you become a Christian? Why do you, even aside from being a pastor sort of professionally or vocationally, what is it that draws you to Christian community?
So, I grew up in a church context. And so in some ways I've always been around it. And so at a very early age, it's something I had been thinking about and believing, and sort of made personal decision to say, yeah, I do buy into this. Maybe I was 7 or 8, although I would say there's stages of it. And so, obviously a lot of people, they're influenced by their family and background and all those things. And I think that those are good things in terms of how you get shaped and developed. But there are moments as you grow up where you do need to say, I take this for my own. I want to express this for my own. And so there's sort of different hinge points for me where I think that became more, I'm doing this because I'm around my family, but no, I'm doing this because also, like, I believe this for myself. And so when I was a teenager, that was one critical moment. And college was probably one of the biggest ones. My mom dropped me off at college. And I remember thinking to myself, so do I, it's up to me if I go to church now. No one will know if I stop going. Yeah. I remember that was a critical moment of, I remember sitting down saying, okay, what do I really believe for myself? Or what have I believed because everyone's told me that I believe it? Mm-hmm, and, and yeah, I think those moments are powerful. Those are important moments for all of us to have. And for me, it was like, yeah, I think I do believe this. I believe this for myself. And I want to continue to live this out, what I think the Bible refers to as what it means to be a community of people who know and follow Jesus. And I think for me, what keeps me in it is, honestly, I think the uniqueness of the Christian message, of how it does legitimately draw people, whoever they are, where they come from, and isn't eliminating my difference. And so for me, you know, obviously I'm Black, my parents are Haitian, so I have that ethnic background as well. And I get a chance to express all of that in a way that's not, Christianity is not asking me to eliminate that or sort of assimilate into something that denies that, but allows me to express that. And express that in ways that actually draws other people who are very different from me into sort of these closer bonds of unity and intimacy with one another, if I can sort of use that word, that continues to be really special. And I've told people, even when church isn't working well, I still buy into it in a sense of, because I know what it can be. And so often church can be, I've told people, you know, no one can hurt you like the church, but no one can bless you like the church in the same way, because it is stepping into those sort of such deep bonds of relationship. And I think that the potential of that, and when it's realized, is always been beautiful for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I have a handful of follow-up questions even from that before we dive in more to what I want to talk about from your book. So you mentioned your parents are Haitian. We have the church building that our church meets in is also used by a Haitian congregation and by a Nepalese congregation, which is sort of delightful.
That's awesome.
To kind of share the space. Did you grow up in a church that was majority sort of Haitian background, or was it a mixed ethnicity church as well? Or what was your?
Yeah, my earliest church memories were in a sort of an Haitian church, so completely Haitian. But then pretty early on, let me say like third, fourth grade, somewhere in there, my parents started going to an English speaking church. I think they really wanted me to experience something broader than just Haitian community. And and then we started just going, just basically there primarily. We were kind of going to both the Haitian church and then really, I would say more kind of a, I wouldn't say, not quite multi-ethnic, but close to it. And so probably doesn't mean predominantly white, but not so much so that it was like 90% or 100%, right? And so, and I think a lot of people like me who've grown up in immigrant families who were born in the States, I sort of was growing up understanding Haitian, but responding to my parents in English. And so I think that was part of it. You know, I wasn't learning as much in the Haitian community because I wasn't speaking Creole as much as I should have. And so I think that was part of the change there as well. And so that's what led us to, so that's primary, a lot of my spiritual development from about fourth grade on was that kind of the English speaking church.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And you did your undergrad at Princeton. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was chatting with a friend just this past week who is a student at Harvard at the moment. She's doing graduate studies there. And she was sharing about a friend of hers who had gone to Harvard as an undergrad, and they'd both moved. They were both from the South originally. And when her friend had moved to go to study at Harvard, I think her friend had maybe been perhaps more of a cultural Christian, less sort of serious in her own faith necessarily. And there was a sort of concern as she went to Harvard that like, oh, well, most probably when she goes to like a big, bad secular university like Harvard, any faith that she might have had is going to crumble away. She's going to be sort of sucked into this vortex of secular humanism or whatever it is. In actual fact, apparently the exact reverse happened. She went to Harvard and like her faith just sort of sprang up in this really, really beautiful way. What was your experience like going to Princeton? Did you feel like it was a place that there was sort of hostility to faith that pulled you in a certain direction, or was it an experience where, well, I'll let you fill in what the experience was rather than giving you multiple options there, but I'm curious.
I'm glad you asked this question because a lot of us worry about what's going to happen for those of us who are Christians, who have kids, who go into school, what's going to happen when they go into those environments. And I would say, I mean, there's two things. I was fortunate to have, I think campuses that have really strong Christian communities, even if they're small, but they're sort of, they're they're legit. People who really care about the college students and invest in their lives is really huge. And so I think that was very significant for me. You know, I was an athlete as well in college, and so to some degree, I was a Division I athlete, and so I was exposed to, that kind of level of athletics.
What sport did you do?
I was track, so okay. I was a sprinter. Yeah.
And oh, so, I see. Okay. I won't be challenging you to any races anytime
soon. Yeah, you will lose. Badly.
No, I indeed. For all sorts of reasons.
I don't know. I'm quite older now, so I probably would break a hamstring, maybe, right. A couple meters in. So
you would win, but injure yourself. In
That's
course.
Right. And so, yeah, I'll say it. I mean, I was all the parties, all the opportunities to do all sorts of different things. A lot of that kind of athletic scene. Yeah, in school at Princeton, it's just all sorts of opportunities to all sorts of do different things. There was a course I remember called the Faith Buster course that, the professor really wanted to sort of bust Christian people's faith, right? And show here's the things you've heard, et cetera. I think what was really important for me was pretty quickly that Christian community had found me and connected me to other people. And those leaders were great about, hey, here's the Christian faith, but what are your questions? What are your doubts? There's space for that, right? And so I think that was really significant and huge for me. But then number two, and probably even more important than number one, in the end of the day, the faith of my parents, but particularly my mom, I would say, I went back to that. So my parents, my father left my family when I was like 17, 18. I haven't spoken to him in like 30 years. He just left. And seeing how my mom responded to that, I think I often tell people, I think Christianity really earns its stripes, if I can put it that way. Mm-hmm. Not when things are going well, but when things are going bad. Mm-hmm. What do you do? And to see my mom say, Jesus still matters. And, I want to say the church didn't handle it well. I don't think they talked to my father in the ways that I wish they had pursued him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mom was saying, people mess up and there's still space for that. There's grace for that. And so I just, in many ways, that the significance of seeing authentic faith lived out close to me while I was growing up is something that was always in the back of my mind. Whatever party I was at, whatever opportunities were in front of me, the thing I kept going back to is, I could keep going down this road and I could see where it leads, but I see, not just the faith of my community, my college, but just how my mom handled things. And again, especially in difficulty, that always resonated with me. That was that thought, there's a lot of ways of sort of putting together your sense of the world and how you're going to live the world. And I felt like the faith I saw exhibited in my community at Princeton, but particularly the faith exhibited in my mom, made the most sense to me.
Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful. One of the ways I sometimes try to explain to people why church shouldn't be dismissed, even though there are many people who have been hurt. And, I might be talking to somebody who themselves has been experienced hurt in the context of church, or somebody who has, read abuse scandals or, been exposed through friends or family members to the terrible things that can happen to people in the context of church. And I think many people draw the not unreasonable conclusion, like, oh, well, if bad things can and do happen in the context of church, then we're better off without church. One of the things that I often say to sort of help people think differently about that is to say, let's think about family. The fact is, most of us have been hurt in the context of family. I'm sure you were hurt by your dad leaving when you were 17. And that is real and that is true. And we're not drawing the conclusion from that, therefore, let's not bother with family. Because we actually know that, like you were saying earlier about church, we know that family, in fact, is also the source of this extraordinary potential for love. Like that many, many of the best things that we've ever experienced will have come one way or another in the context of family. So talk us through, you recently published this book that sort of focused on church love in particular, I guess. Talk us through how you think about that sort of theologically and how that translates practically, like even in your local church context, how we can experience God's love in the family of the church.
The reason I wrote the book is something I've been experiencing, and I'm not alone in this. I think we look around and there seems increased polarization, division, separation. And for me, if there's a calling card for my ministry, the thing that people are going to always hear me talk about is what is community, what brings people mm-hmm. together, what keeps them together. Mm-hmm. And that's harder, it seems, to do than ever. And particularly if you're concerned to have or care about having what I call diverse communities, a community that mm-hmm. reflects as many different type of ethnic groups and social classes, et cetera. That's harder than ever. You could argue that it's not worth doing to sort of bring people together. But again, not just bring them together, but keep them together. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I think I've always been thinking of different ways of thinking about that, talking about that, expressing that. And the short answer to that is, of course, what we're talking about is love. How do we help people love one another well? Mm-hmm. And it struck me that maybe one of the most powerful and vibrant ways the Bible talks about love is God's love for us. And the Bible uses this really, and I realize for those of you not familiar with the Bible, this is kind of a striking metaphor. The Bible talks about God loving us like a husband loves his bride. So I use this word beloved love, that the love of God towards us should feel like being in the very best marriages. And mm-hmm. of course, we're in the realm of metaphor. And so human marriage doesn't 100% equate to the spiritual marriage of God's people, the church with God. But it's an important one. It's saying that for many people, the world seems to operate as like a struggle. Like, you know, you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop, right? And so you think of God or some higher being is sort of against you, you're struggling against them. Other people might think of, you know, whatever God or higher beings out there is someone they got to sort of manipulate or cajole to like get them to do what they want. Mm. And I think that this imagery of the Bible gives us is saying God is a God who leans in towards us with love. And not just any type of love, a passionate, vibrant, intimate, delighted, affectionate love. Again, that sort of beloved love. And it really struck me, though, that love of God, as it comes from God to us, also now flows among us. And so the Bible talks about how God has united himself to us in Christ such that he's now in us and his love is in us. And that love can be expressed in a lot of different ways. It's expressed as a familial type of love, right? So we're family in God. It's a kind of love of a shepherd for his sheep. And so it's a love that protects and guides. But I think I would argue it's also a beloved love, that God's love isn't sort of partitioned off. It's all of his love is in us by his Spirit. Romans 5:5, right? God's love has been poured into our hearts by the Spirit. And so that is also a beloved love that's in us. And I can draw from that love and how I then relate to other people. And I think that's sort of just a powerful way of opening up maybe new categories of thinking about love in the life of the church. And again, it's not to suggest that the church is a place where I'm acting like I'm married to people. But it is a way in which I'm saying, you're beloved to me, and I'm beloved to you, and you're beloved to me, because we're all beloved to God in Christ Jesus. And so I want to see you and treat you as beloved because you're beloved to the one who sees me as beloved. And I can draw from that love within me. As I might say, just well within me now that is filled with the beloved love of God, and I want to draw from that. And so, yeah, so that opens up the different sort of practical ways than I think we might can think of love that we don't often think of when we think of love, loving one another. And so there's a chapter on intimacy in the book, and just sort of reclaiming that sense of an intimate love for people. And I think that's just powerful for people who in communities who may feel alone, who are single, or don't have even marriages in their lives. That there's intimate love available to you in the life of the church. That does matter. And that is, that echoes even into eternity. And so there's a kind of intimate love. And then that's expressed in a lot of different ways. I mean, the significance of touch, right? Done well in healthy ways is one way in which that can happen. The significance of presence, of being with one another, a couple of different things. We can go through any of the ones that you're thinking of here, but I just love thinking in those kind of ways, new ways maybe, but I think ways that are legit as we think of God's love coming from God to us and now among us.
Ever since Jesus's female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, seminary president Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort, and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold. Yeah, and it's fascinating that you mentioned that metaphor of Jesus and his churches, the in Christian marriage, the husband and wife are sort of meant to be playing out that drama almost. Like, that's what Christian marriage is designed to point us to, that greater love.
Yeah.
And I talk about all that, that metaphor all the time in the context of sort of sexual and, you know, theological understanding of sexuality. But I think one of the places it's really fascinating as we think about church is that that metaphor depends on the biblical teaching that we together as God's people, if we're Christians, are one body. It's not that, you know, Jesus is married to like however many million different brides, some of whom are female, some of whom are male, some of whom, you know, like, it's actually that we together are his bride if we're in Christ. And if that's true, then it means that not only are you and I brother and sister together, which we are, and that's another kind of clear biblical refrain, but we're also part of the same body. Like, we are, spiritually speaking, as close to one another as, you know, my finger is to my big toe or whatever. Like, you know, we're sort of, there's no separating us if we're in Christ. And that needs to be visible in the Christian community, not just on a Sunday morning, but also sort of throughout the week. What would you say, as you think about your own church context, Pastor V, I love calling you that, and like whether it's in your immediate local church or experiences that you've had in other church contexts as well, what would you say are some like concrete examples of where you've seen this happening at its best?
Yeah, I mean, I've been blessed to be in mostly healthy and good church environments. I'm very thankful for it, because it just reminds me, again, church at its best, is there's nothing like it. And this sort of, again, just if I can use that word, this kind of beloved love that now knits me to other people has led to, one example I've often given. I don't think I actually tell this story in the book, but our first two kids are adopted. And so we adopted them when they're 7 and 4. We were fostering them first, and then we were trying to move towards adopting them. In Arizona, you have to have because they're brother and sister siblings, and we had to have separate bedrooms for them. And we were living, Danae and I were living in a condo. We were a year and a half into our marriage when we began this process. And so it was just a, you know, 2-bedroom condo. So we needed basically 3 bedrooms. And in fostering them, you know, at this point, we couldn't only foster them on weekends. They were with another foster family during the week because we didn't have the right housing. And so we began looking for a house. It was going to be a long process. And this idea of the kids going back and forth really is not great for them, not great for us. And it was another couple in my small group who basically said, you know, we have a 3-bedroom house. Why don't we switch houses with you? They didn't have kids. And we just switch houses. And I couldn't believe, they meant it. And that's what happened. Basically, it was a small church at this point. But basically, so the whole church turned out, you know, like 30, 40 people, and basically helped us move everything from their house into our condo, everything from our condo into their house. And because that basically allowed us a time to begin immediately having them with us full time while we continued to look for a house that would meet state standards. So that's what happened. So we switched houses, and so we lived in that house. And this other couple in our small group lived in their house for a couple months until we finally were able to close in a house then move more permanently into that house. And that's just, why would anyone do this? It's sacrificial love, right? It's a love that shows that, hey, what we share all this together. I think it's unique expression of saying, essentially, you said, we're all one together, right? Joined together by the love of God in Christ Jesus. So that's one of the more powerful examples I've experienced in my life.
Well, and when you say, why would anybody do that? It's the sort of thing that actually people might do if they were biologically related. Like, you can imagine, grandparents saying to their kids, oh, we know you're in this situation. Like, why don't you use our place for a while? We use you. Like, we have a conception of that kind of love in biological family or in legal family at least. And if we take the Bible seriously, we need to have those exact same norms in the local church. So that's a beautiful example of it. I think of I recently, a few months ago, met the mother of a dear friend of mine, who is a member of our community group, and not uncommonly just kind of come and have dinner at our house, whether it's for community group or like at other times. She's always welcome in our house. And she had reported to me that a number of times her mother has like told her off for showing up at my house and expecting to be fed. And my friend's been saying to her mom, no, it's really like, it's fine. And her mom's like, no, I didn't raise you to show up. And she was like, she has children to feed and you show up. And so when I met her mom, we had this sort of, because her mother brought this up again. She was like, I keep telling her that she can't just show up to your house. And I was like, please believe me when I say that, yes, she can. And I love that she does. And I love that she like opens the door of my fridge and like helps herself to whatever. And like, that's because she's part of our family. And
yeah, that's great.
You wouldn't be surprised. Like if we were biological sisters, you wouldn't think, well, that's weird to show up at your sister's house and expect to like be included in whatever food's going around. and I think all of us.
Well, this is good knowledge.
Right.
I will keep that in mind next time I'm in the area. If
brother,
what's your address?
Walk in anytime. I'll text it to you later.
All right.
So help us think, Vimone. There might be some people listening to this who think, do you know what? Sounds like a nice idea, but honestly, the idea of going, and it's a vulnerable thing to even start going to a church, to show up when you don't know anybody, you're not sure what the expectations are, or you know, are people going to be weird? Am I going to fit in? It's a big step in many people's minds to even sort of try out church, or if you're somebody who's been showing up to church for a while but hasn't really kind of lent into the kind of love that we're talking about in church. How would you encourage that person to say, do you know what, it is actually worth it? It's worth the risk, it's worth the vulnerability, it's worth the potential of hurt to get involved in a community of sinners like any normal local church is.
I mean, so I want to resonate with what people are experiencing there and the fear that's there and the risk that's there. But yet, I want to see what's the alternative. I think the alternative is to sort of never experience the kind of love that delights in you for who you are, that notices you and pays attention to you, that is willing to move towards you and stay with you, even through conflict. I think it's one of the most powerful examples of God's love for us, is that He creates time and space for us to not ignore our conflict, but to deal with it, the grace that's needed there. It's similar to why do people have friendships? Why do people get married? There's a huge risk there to move in towards someone else. But the result, I think, is so beautiful and so worth it that it makes I think the Bible has this great line there. It was in 2 Corinthians, how sort of all our afflictions and troubles one day will be seen as light and momentary compared to the weight of glory.
Yeah.
So in some ways, it's like, I want to paint a picture of what church community at its very best can be, which is sort of an encouragement to fight for that or keep looking for that. Because once you find it, you realize, oh, this is worth it. Because what you have outside of that can be good, but it's not all it could be and should be.
Yeah. Yeah.
That we were, I want to say human beings were meant to be in relationship and to be connected to others. And that there's something, you can live a human life alone and apart, but you're not really, there's ways of knowing yourself and being and expressing yourself that can only happen in the context of community. And I would argue the church community provides the fullest palette of that happening.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love that metaphor of the palette, the sort of range of different connections that we can have. So I'm curious for your thoughts on this. My sense is that both in the sort of broader culture and in a slightly different way in church culture, we've too often bought into the idea that romantic relationships and marriage are like the only, that's the real place for intimacy. And, you know, maybe parent-child relationships, like we sort of have those two categories. And so if you're not experiencing either of those kinds of relationship, then you just kind of have to suck it up and be lonely. Yeah. Like you can't be vulnerable, you can't be expressive, you can't like all that sense of genuine closeness to where I can laugh with you, I can cry with you, I can hug you, I can tell you that you hurt my feelings, or and expect you to actually kind of listen and hear me out, and for us to be able to work through that we sort of culturally have a category for that in romantic or sexual relationships. I think in church circles we often kind of limit that to husbands and wives and children and like a sort of biological family setup. But I'm increasingly convinced that actually all of us need, you know, regardless of whether we are or are not married and whether we are or are not taking care of kids, we actually all need a broader community We thrive when we are having genuine, deep love relationships with a range of people, in a range of ways, to a range of, even to a range of degrees. Like, there might be the people we are routinely like seeing and very close to, and then the people who we sort of catch up with every now and then, but it's actually really meaningful. So help us think, and I don't think this is, I certainly don't think this is like fully gendered, but I'm curious for your thoughts on how somebody's listening to this, and like maybe they're a man who, I'm told that men often find it harder to just make those kinds of connections, have that, like have the vulnerability required to have real intimacy in the context of friendships. And so I'm sort of curious for your wisdom or ideas or thoughts or challenges for other guys. Could be certainly relevant for women as well, but I think on average maybe there's more of a challenge there.
Yeah, I mean, it might often not as readily accessible, I think, for men. And yet I think some of my friendships that I have, and especially some of the shared experiences I've had with people, once you sort of cross the Rubicon, if I can put it that way, and sort of jump over into that sense of like, no, I'm going to be close with this person. I'm going to admit that I'm close with this person. The freedom that's there, actually, that, you know, I think our culture sort of would argue that you sort of have to have it all together and never show weakness or despair or vulnerability. And that leaves you lacking, because of course, like, no one can have it all together all the time. We need relationships to hold us up, to when we need to be held up, for the opportunities for you to hold other people up. And you know, that's what, and both men need that and women need that. And I think the church, again, is one of the more powerful ways in which this gets expressed. And if I could sort of add something else too, as well, you know, I think the life of the church provides an opportunity for intimacy, for affection, and for delight, and for all these things that it doesn't provide everything that, like, let's say a marriage provides, for sure. Obviously, it's not the physical expressions of that, and yet it is powerful and actually echoes into eternity. And in a way that is hard, is a mystery here, but this is not original to me. I think it's Lauren Winer, who says this in her book, that basically our baptism vows outlast our marriage vows. And so for those unfamiliar, baptism is sort of this way in which we express our commitment publicly to the Lord and to one another.
Yeah.
And so the Bible's saying one day that the universe that is going to be held together by one key relationship, God's people together with the Lord. And we're going to be united together in his love and with one another. And which means that, like, that sort of spiritual relationship is going to be so vital, so delightful, so powerful. It's going to sort of outplay, be better than even the best marriages on this earth. Again, that's a mystery to me. There's a lot, just like, what, you know, there's different details of that I'd love to know more about. And yet it does say something about what we have now, that whoever you are, whether you're married, not married, whatever your sort of understanding of your own, even sexual identity is, the Bible is saying that there's a way in which to experience not everything, but some of the best, what really makes marriages sing, that sense of delight and intimacy and care for one another. We can experience a lot of that now and know that will only grow in a way that will outpace even the very best of marriages on this planet. That when, I think I say this in the book, that when angels sit around the campfires of heaven, the story they tell to each other over and over again is this story of God loving and pursuing his people and what that will result in. God's people loving one another and loving God forever and ever in ways that will get better with each passing day. That's the one story the whole universe hangs on. And we get to live that story now. And so it just puts meaning and purpose to, while you may not experience everything you want to experience on this world, I think as Christians, I love the historic Black church is really good about this as well. This life is not the only life. This life is connected to more life on the other side. And we get to be part of that stream leading into that life and experience a lot of that now with the promise and the guaranteed promise that it will only grow and increase in ways that will far surpass our imagination.
Gosh, that is a perfect way to end, Pastor V. I love it. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about this thing close to both of our hearts, the local church. I love how you keep using the word delight, because it's actually the word that I so often find myself using when describing my my community, my church community here, the people who walk in through my door and my face just lights up because I delight in them, or the people I see at church and I just rush to put my arms around them because I delight in them. That we can, and we can experience in the delight that we can have in one another, we can get a little taste of Jesus's delight in us, which is so shocking. I was talking just now with a younger believer who was saying that he sort of noticing ways in which the Lord has kind of orchestrated things for him in the last few months. And he said, I feel like so unworthy of it, but yet I see God's love in it. And I said, yeah, none of us are worthy of it. And yet Jesus loves us so much that he was ready to die with us. How much more is he going to be orchestrating our lives and bringing us into eternity with him?
Yeah, that's good.
Well, thanks again, brother. You guys have been listening to the Confronting Christianity podcast. I've been chatting with Vimone Pierre about his, about our shared love for Jesus and for his church, and also about his new book, Dearly Beloved, How God's Love His Church Deepens Our Love for Each Other. I highly commend that book to you. If you would like, you can follow us on Instagram or Twitter/X. You can leave a review on iTunes and suggest a question that you'd like to see engaged in a future episode. And I hope that you have a fabulous week and that you find the opportunity to delight in a brother or a sister in Christ in the next week. And if you don't yet know Jesus as your Lord, I pray that you have the opportunity to delight in him, the one who first loved you.